Hello, and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where I shall be continuing my series talking about the decline and fall of the Roman Republic. Last time I talked to you all about the life and career and times of Tiberius Gracchus, and this time I shall be talking about the next sort of great event in that narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Republic, the story of his little brother, Gaius Gracchus. So let's just jump straight in. Gaius Gracchus was about 9 years younger than Tiberius, and so his career, he takes his place on the stage of history about 10 years later. He was only 21 when his older brother was killed. So he was about the same age as his older brother when he gets involved in politics, 30 odd. Again, there's lots and lots of parallels between these two brothers, their careers. And they would be in the faction what would later be called the Populares. Now, these two factions, a lot of you may already know about them, didn't really occur until a bit later, formally. They were never formal parties, the Optimates and the Populares. But the Optimates were the faction which were for tradition and for the senatorial class and for the status quo. And the Populares were for the people, the populist party, if you like. But those two factions really only kind of apply to the senatorial class. And as I say, they were never sort of ever formally strictly parties in any way. And there was a lot of crossover. Someone like Julius Caesar, for example, was always staunchly Populares, but a lot of senators, a lot of power players would swap sides, and there'd be traditional in one set of policies but popular in another. And it wasn't a strict cut and dry case where every single person that was rich and landed would be an Optimate and every single pleb or normal person of Rome was a Populares. There was some crossover, and it gets a lot more messy the further through time we get. So that's something to mention. At this point, during the time of Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, these two factions hadn't really properly solidified yet, but we see it all happening here, and particularly under the tribunates of Gaius Gracchus. They really start to appear for the first time, but the historians don't really talk about these two factions massively yet. Now, to talk about the sources, super quick, there's actually very little for this period. We've got Appian and we've got Plutarch. And Appian doesn't talk about Gaius Gracchus all that much. There's a few pages, 4 or 5 pages, and he skates over things quite quickly because his book is all about the civil wars and he's interested in getting to the Marius and Sulla and Pompey and Caesar days. So we don't actually get a great deal in Appian about Gaius Gracchus. But Plutarch, we've got a whole life of Gaius Gracchus in Plutarch. So I'm going to quote entirely from Plutarch today, because it really is the only source. I reread the bit in Tom Holland's Rubicon, a superb book all about this, and I listened to a few podcasts. Dan Carlin's got a great podcast on the death throes of the Republic, and read the bits in Theodore Mommsen. But everyone that talks about this, they're just taking their account from Plutarch and their analysis of what Plutarch says, because they haven't got any other choice. So I thought, I'll just largely read to you directly from the horse's mouth, so to speak. I'll just be quoting to you from Plutarch, because you can't get any better than that, really. But one thing to say, if Plutarch was lying for whatever reason, or was misrepresenting the truth, again, for whatever reason, then we're screwed. That's all we've got to go on. So bear that in mind when I read you out what Plutarch says. We just have to take it for read that he's being completely honest. But there you go. That's the plight of the classicist, of the ancient historian, that you've quite often got very few, or sometimes even quite often one real source. And that's it, you've got to take it or leave it. Okay, so let's jump straight in. Plutarch says this, quote, "After his brother's death, Gaius Gracchus at first withdrew completely from the forum and played no part in public life. He may have been afraid of his political enemies, or he may have wished to make them appear still more detestable in the eyes of the people. At any rate, he stayed quietly at home, like a man who had been humbled for the present and who intended for the future to remain aloof from political life. Indeed, some people even went so far as to attack him on the grounds that he disapproved of Tiberius's policy and had repudiated it." Not true at all. "But it must also be said that he was still scarcely more than a boy." Well, he was 21 at the time, and all through his 20s sort of remained quiet. So not really a boy, but anyway, Plutarch goes on. "Since he was 9 years younger than Tiberius, who had not reached 30 when he died. But as time went on, his character gradually revealed itself. He had no inclination for a life of idleness, nor for effete amusements, nor for the pleasures of the table, nor was he interested in making money. But by developing his powers of oratory, as if these were the wings which would carry him to the heights of public life. He clearly showed that he had no intention of remaining inactive. And when a friend of his, named Vettius, had to stand his trial, and Gaius undertook his defence, the force of his eloquence aroused the people to an ecstatic, almost frenzied enthusiasm, and made the efforts of the other pleaders appear quite childish by comparison. So the long dormant fears of the aristocratic party revived once more, and there was much anxious talk to the effects that Gaius must be prevented from becoming a tribune. So two things there. He is supposed to have been Gaius Gracchus, a superbly powerful orator. Tiberius, his older brother, was thought of as a great orator, but Gaius is considered even higher. Will Durant says that he was, until Cicero came along, he was the greatest orator Rome had ever seen. So you can sort of assume he's one of the best ever to do it in sort of all of history, up there with some of the very best. And Tiberius was always spoken of as very, very mild in his oratory, that he was conciliatory and that he was unflappable. I used that word last time. Well, Gaius is highly flappable. He's very emotional, turbulent even. There's accounts where he would sort of rip at his toga, sort of pull the toga off his shoulder to sort of bare his chest, and he'd get carried away. To the point where there's one anecdote which is really interesting, where he would even employ a servant or a slave to sort of stand behind him and whisper in his ear if he got too carried away, if he was going too far, if he started, you know, really ranting, sort of Hitler style. His servant would whisper in his ear, like, calm down, calm down. And he would, and apparently he always would, whenever, you know, his servant had a quick word in his shell, like, Gaius would immediately calm down, because he realised it wasn't a good look to actually rant like a madman. But nevertheless, he was fiery, he was passionate. And so he gets described as a demagogue, and it seems like he was a rabble-rouser, and, well, a bit of a demagogue. It's another way, that's a good word for it, I think. But being a demagogue isn't necessarily bad. You know, what if right is on your side? Well, in that case, I don't think there's anything wrong with being a demagogue. Whipping people up into a frenzy for the right cause, I don't see any problem with that personally, but there you go. Some of you might disagree with me. So Plutarch tells us that at first Gaius actually didn't want to get involved in politics, sort of the higher offices of politics in Rome anyway. But he, quote, found it impossible to resist the appeals of his friends and of the people that he should enter public life. A bit further down, Plutarch says, yet in spite of these facts, it is often alleged that Gaius was an out-and-out demagogue who was far more eager to win the good opinion of the masses than his brother Tiberius had ever been. But the truth is quite different, namely that Gaius seemed to have been drawn into public life by necessity rather than choice. We also have the testimony of Cicero the orator, about a generation later, who says that Gaius had begun by shunning any prospect of office and had decided to live in retirement when his brother appeared to him in a dream and said, why do you hesitate, Gaius? There is no escape. Fate has decreed the same destiny for us both. We live and die in the service of the people. End quote. Now, there are also a lot of parallels with the two Gracchi brothers, with the two Kennedy brothers, John and Robert Kennedy, where when Robert Kennedy ran to be president in the late 60s, he had already lived through the assassination of his older brother, and it deeply, deeply affected him. Dan Carlin makes this point very, very well, that Bobby Kennedy, before and after Jack had been killed, was a sort of a different man. Afterwards, he was much more radical and also much more cautious, if that makes any kind of sense. He knew what might lie in store for him if he wasn't careful, but actually his worldview and his policies were even more hardline. Well, that's the same for Gaius Gracchus. He was now a much harder line, a much more radical version of his older brother. And the times had changed. You know, from 1963 to 1968, you know, the world had moved on. And politics was even more filled with emotion than it had been. Same goes for Rome. Tensions had heightened, if anything. But the senatorial class had thought they'd sort of put the genie back in the bottle after they'd clubbed Tiberius and a few hundred of his followers to death and thrown them in the Tiber. Because for a few years, things did go back to normal. There weren't any sort of radical demagogue-style tribunes trying to go over the head of the Senate. But as soon as Gaius Gracchus becomes a tribune, which is in a bit, I'll get to his earlier career, but once he becomes a tribune, it's sort of immediately obvious that he's going to start stirring the hornet's nest once more. So, Gaius Gracchus's earlier career. He became a quaestor, which is sort of like a... There's different types of quaestors, whether they're civic ones or military ones. It seems that he was a military quaestor, which is a type of administrative role, perhaps to do with the balancing of books and things as well. And he was posted to Sardinia. And when you were posted to Sardinia, there was a proconsul, sort of an ex-consul, in charge of Sardinia as a Roman overseas territory. And the proconsul would have, formally, legally, a set of helpers to help him do all the administration, including his quaestors. So Gaius Gracchus is sort of attached to this proconsul. When the proconsul goes to Sardinia, he goes with him. When the proconsul comes back to Rome after his term of office, it's then that his quaestors, Gaius Gracchus and others, can return to Rome with him. This proconsul was called Orestes. So Gaius Gracchus had been in the army 4 years and then achieved the office of quaestor. And he was down in Sardinia for 2 years. And then at the end, when his term was sort of up, or should really have been up, the Senate passed a decree, because they know what's coming. They suspect exactly what and who Gaius Gracchus really is. So they pass a decree keeping the proconsul Orestes in Sardinia for another year. And it's all kind of obviously just a ploy to keep Gaius Gracchus out of politics in Rome. And apparently it's just clear to everybody involved that that's what this is all about. And Gaius Gracchus is sort of, I suppose, old enough and ready to sort of dive into Roman politics, urban Roman politics. So he just sort of defies that decree and returns to Rome. Now, when he gets to Rome, his enemies say immediately try and pull him up on charges for that. You can't just desert your consul, the proconsul, the administrative ruler of Sardinia. You can't just do that. But where Gaius Gracchus was sort of a great lawyer, we already said already he sort of defended people in court and things, and a superb orator, he knew his mind and he knew how to express it, and he couldn't be messed with very easily. He says, no, it's just by convention that quaestors, after a year, or certainly two at most, have to stay with their proconsul. I don't have to, there's no law saying that. And you never passed a law, it was just sort of an order. So, no, I haven't broken any law by coming back to Rome. He acquits himself in the law courts. And so his enemies try to pull him up on any other charges, any other sort of trumped up charges they can get. Pun kind of intended, like Trump, just anything they can find to charge against him, no matter how tiny or ridiculous or unjust they do. So, for example, one of the winters he was in Sardinia, it was extremely cold, and Gaius Gracchus is sent to a nearby kingdom to get sort of a whole bunch of warmer clothes sent over to Sardinia to clothe the legionaries there, so they don't freeze to death in the hills of Sardinia. But apparently this, quote, alarmed the Senate, and they charged that Gaius Gracchus was, quote, attempting to win support of the masses, end quote. One, what's really wrong with that? And two, it's just a trumped up charge, isn't it? You know, trying to make sure your men don't freeze to death. It's not a crime, is it? Also, while in Sardinia, Gaius Gracchus had tried to, or did, sort of procure more grain for the Romans that are on Sardinia. And apparently the senators, quote, took offence at that, that in any tiny way, even if it's the right thing to do, in any tiny way, Gaius Gracchus, as a quaestor, that's his sort of thing, administrative and logistics and, you know, gaining victuals, you know, feeding people, making sure everything works properly, people don't freeze or starve to death, that is sort of the job of a quaestor in all sorts of ways. But if any tiny moment he'd gone above and beyond what he was sort of formally legally allowed to do, they try to bring charges against him. But again, we're told he just acquits himself. And so much so that anyone that heard him speak, who wasn't, you know, his actual political enemy, would be, quote, completely won over to his sympathies. And to top it all off, Gaius Gracchus points out, wherever possible, to anyone that would listen, that he returned from Sardinia without a full purse, i.e. he didn't extort money out of the Sardinian people, which was just de rigueur, it was just par for the course. That's just sort of one of the perks of empire, is that you get to wring money out of people. But he never did. And that nearly everyone else that came back had wine jars, amphora, massive jars meant for holding wine, quote, crammed with gold and silver. And yet he had none, showing, just like his older brother, that he was just and he took duty seriously and justice seriously. And he wasn't in the business of extortion. Again, the poor people, the masses of Rome, the urban plebs, loved him for that. So Plutarch says that after all the various accusations and indictments when he comes back from Sardinia, quote, Gaius was able to clear himself completely, and once he had proved his innocence, he immediately began to campaign for election as tribune. All the most distinguished men in Rome, without exception, joined forces to oppose him. But such an immense multitude poured into the city, an immense multitude of normal people, poured into the city from various parts of Italy to support his candidature, that many of them could find no lodgings. So Rome got filled up from all the surrounding countryside. And these aren't people to vote in the assemblies. They're just there to see and hear Gaius Gracchus and lend their voices to cheer him on. Plutarch goes on, and since the Campus Martius, a giant open bit of ground at this point, you know, giant like Central Park or Hyde Park, and since the Campus Martius was too small to hold them, they climbed onto the attics and the rooftops to declare their support for Gaius. So he was sort of from the off, a darling of the people, and of course the senatorial class, fear and loathe him. He's very divisive. So in his first attempt to become a tribune of the people, he actually comes fourth in the election, but that's still enough to become one of the 10 tribunes. Plutarch says, quote, he quickly asserted his predominance over the other tribunes, for he was incomparably the finest orator in Rome, and the grief he had suffered encouraged him to speak out fearlessly whenever he lamented the fate of his brother. He seized every occasion to lead the people back to this subject and remind them of what had happened to Tiberius. He also even rebukes some of his older brother's followers from 9-10 years previously. He says things like, look, you basically didn't do enough to save his life. You could have tried harder on that day. He sort of deserted him. And remember that the normal course of events, the law, had not been followed. The law was that if Tiberius had been guilty of a crime, that the law courts need to bring up charges, and then he needs to answer and have a trial. You don't just club people to death, certainly not tribunes of the people. You don't just club them to death. And what have you done since? You haven't really brought all the people to account for any of that. You know, if Tiberius had been brought up on charges and then refused to come to the law courts, the procedure is that a trumpeter goes outside his house and trumpets his trumpet. And then if Tiberius doesn't come out, then you're sort of in a position where mobs or violence or force can be used. But none of that happened. None of that procedure was followed. He was just killed on the spot. So among the many things I intend to do during my time as tribune, all sorts of reforms, a lot of Tiberius's reforms, I'm going to continue them on and go further, if anything. I'm also going to try and get some sort of at least political revenge on the people that are responsible for it. So again, he doesn't really make a secret of any of this stuff. And so he's just garnering all sorts of enemies, powerful, rich and powerful enemies, who are themselves fairly implacable and certainly ruthless if and when it comes to it. So one of the first things Gaius Gracchus does, and he does, just like his older brother, he just does go straight to the people, the assemblies, the popular assembly, just completely ignoring the Senate. And he wants to get Marcus Octavius disqualified. You remember, that was the other tribune who was the nemesis of Tiberius Gracchus and the pawn of the landed senatorial class. He wants to get him disqualified. And another guy, Popilius Laena, who had been heavily involved in the killings and subsequent prosecutions of Tiberius's following, wants to get him disqualified to answer in some way for what they'd done to Tiberius Gracchus and that whole faction. And where I said earlier that Gaius Gracchus was quite an impassioned speaker, not only was it sort of the tone and intonation and substance of what he said, but it was actually even the words he used were sometimes really quite rude. Or Plutarch says, quote, Gaius was never squeamish in his choice of words, quote. So there's one example when someone in the Senate who was openly known to be homosexual was quite rude about Cornelia, Gaius's mother, Gaius and Tiberius's mother. And Gaius apparently shot back by saying, you know, my mother's a saint. You've slept with more men than she has. Or you've slept with men more recently than she has. Which was apparently a very, very rude and scandalous thing to say publicly on the record, as it were. Yeah, so he's got a sharp tongue, old Gaius Gracchus. Okay, so let's talk all about his programme of reform. Now, all the historians, all the secondary historians, people like Wilderant or Mommsen or Holland, they all say that we don't know, because Plutarch doesn't explicitly tell us, we don't know in what order the various sets of reforms that Gaius Gracchus suggests. We don't know in what order they played out. Now, it sort of does matter. You can kind of infer what's likely, but we don't know for sure. So I'll just go through the main ones and leave the most important one till last. So first of all, roads. Rome is very, very famous, isn't it, for being road builders. Well, it's actually only under Gaius Gracchus in the 120s BC where they build loads more roads. And Plutarch says, it specifically says, that they're built in a straight line. That's a cliche, isn't it? That all Roman roads are built perfectly in a straight line. Well, they're not. Of course they're not. Anyone that knows anything about it, you know, the ancient Romans didn't literally level mountains and re-divert all rivers. They didn't cut tunnels straight through the Alps or anything to make sure all their roads were in a perfectly straight line. Where possible, they'd make them in a straight line, which is just, you know, the most efficient thing to do. But some people have taken that line of Plutarch's, that all Roman roads are built in a straight line, to think that's literally exactly true. Well, of course it's not. But apparently these roads were sort of, well, they are a great example of engineering, and they did really join up big swathes of Italy. And that also generated large amounts of employment, because Rome at this time, as had been for a few generations, sort of filled with the urban poor or homeless, particularly the Aventine Hill. There were lots and lots of extremely poor people, unemployed poor people in Rome. And so if you can put them to work, a bit like Roosevelt's New Deal, if we can just put them to work in any way, that's just better, at least for the short term. And it obviously, kind of obviously, doesn't it? It just helps the economy, that people can get things to and from market quicker and easier and more efficiently. So it's just it was a boon for Rome, Gaius Gracchus' road building programme. There are a few reforms in the army. One that was that he made sure that conscription only began at 17. In other words, you know, let's not have child soldiers. That's not a great look, is it? So you have to at least be 17 before you can join the army. The normal people, again, loved that. They didn't necessarily like their children, or, you know, like 14-year-olds or whatever, going into the army and getting killed overseas before they can even grow a beard. You know, so that's another thing that the people loved him for. And to just sort of, in most general terms, improve conditions a bit in the army. Again, make sure they've got warm clothes when need be. Make sure they don't starve to death. You'd think these bases had already been covered, but no, not necessarily. And at this time already, a lot of the army were poor people. Now, people that know about this might know that in a generation's time, or not even a generation's time, Gaius Marius, brings in many of his reforms. And quite often it's said then, the fairly low resolution view is, that it was only then really that he allowed completely unlanded poor people, peasants, into the army. Well, although that's true, that trend had already begun. So again, the poorer people were extremely grateful to Gaius Gracchus for improving their conditions, those of them that were in the legions. He brought in a law to sort of try and alleviate famine and hunger in Rome, the Lex Frumentaria. And this meant that the state itself would buy up massive grain supplies in bulk and keep them in these giant warehouses just outside Rome, or at Ostia, not too far from Rome, and then sell it to the people at a massive discount, all for almost nothing. Now, later, in later generations to come, it became completely free. It was a grain dole. And then that became a political tool.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.